when I got this invitation to come and speak to the Friends of the Library, at the Barsmith Library, my father reminded me of the slightly embarrassing fact that after 4 years of doing what you have kindly said, a very good degree, I visited the Barsmith Library once. And that was because I had just started work in the Westminster School Boarding House, just to, as a way of, beginning my education career, and I came in and borrowed Tom Brown's School Days. And that was the sole book that I borrowed from this magnificent library in my entire career, and I'm extremely embarrassed about that fact. But sadly, true. It's lovely to see so many of you here, and it's a great honour to be here. Jill has spoken about my lives of stability, and what I want to talk about today is share some of those moments where I went through periods of instability. That wasn't mental instability, but, at times it seemed like it. So it's great that you've all had a glass of wine. I find that makes talking so much easier, especially the more wine people have had. I usually teach Year 9 students, and it's not often the case that my students are tanked up at the back. I'm going to actually ask and ask a sort of terribly schoolmasterly question, because that's what I've been doing for the last 28 years or however long. I never know who I'm talking to, in the sense that I don't know whether I'm speaking to people who've read my book or my books, or people who haven't, or people who've just wandered in off the street for a free glass of wine, like this gentleman over here. Can I just ask, who has read The Unlikely Voyage of Jack De Crow? Oh, wonderful, great. And anybody's read The Well at the World's End?
Not yet.
Not yet, right, okay. And the others of you didn't do your homework and will see me afterwards. What I will do is, look, I will tell you a little bit about The Unlikely Voyage of Jack De Crow. That tends to be the one that most people want to hear about, but I'm very happy to talk about the other book a little as well, if you'd like. I will certainly take questions, and that's a good way of prompting you to ask what you want to know about. I will have to have somebody wrestling me to the ground, because I will undoubtedly go on and on and on and on and on. It won't be me stopping, it'll be you stopping me. So please, please, somebody appropriate, feel free to do that. And we'll start. It seems odd to tell stories that many of you have already read, but perhaps you will enjoy hearing some of the stories in my voice, with all the funny accents and so on, if I can. So for those of you who don't know, The Unlikely Voyage of Jack De Crow is basically this. Many, many years ago, I worked in England, in Shropshire, in a lovely little school, a small private school, and after six very happy years there, I decided that I needed to leave, go off and do some other things. But I thought, well, I'll leave in style. You know, I'm a drama teacher and we like to do things with a little bit of panache. So I came up with this wonderful idea. I saw a little mirror dinghy, which is a tiny little sailing boat, and I decided that wouldn't it be wonderful to have a party in the woods by the canal, and I would put this little boat in the canal, and all my friends and colleagues and students would come and raise a glass to me and say a farewell, a fond farewell, say nice touching things about me, and I would do the classic thing of rowing away into the sunset. And I suggested that idea. The man who owned the dinghy said, yes, that's fine. Look, wherever you get it to, a day or 2 days, 3 days at the most down the river, I'll come and pick it up. And then you can sort of carry on in your own way. And so it was all arranged. And sure enough, it happened. I had this lovely party. I put this little dinghy, I called it Jack De Crow, named after a tame jackdaw that I'd had called Jack De Crow. It's a long story. Simple, yes. And I did. And I rowed away into the sunset. Very, very shortly, by the way, very shortly discovering that rowing's not that easy. So it wasn't sort of a gentle glide into the sunset. It was more a sort of a zigzagging crash down the canal as I realised it was more difficult than I'd possibly thought. But so I did. I went away. And I went the first day, the first night, the second day, the third, and after that, just got carried away a bit, really, because 14 months later, I had reached the Black Sea. in this little dinghy, the other side of Romania, the Danube Delta. And it was somewhat embarrassing to ring my friend who lent me the dinghy and said, "You know, you said you'd just pick it up from wherever I got it to. Have you heard of Romania? Yeah, I'll just leave it there. Okay, bye, thanks." And but the actual adventures that happened on this voyage, this little voyage, formed the subject of the book, The Unlikely Voyage of Jack DeCrow. There are countless adventures to tell, but let me pick out one or two favourites, and then we might have some questions, and we'll see how it goes. Oh, sorry. This is a prop that I use. It's not the original pith helmet I held, but when I rode away, I'd actually sold off everything I owned. I sold it for charity. I had a big charity auction because I wanted to travel light, and I gave all the money to the Salvation Army because I thought they might be looking after me for the next year or so. But the very few things I kept a few magic tricks in my pocket. I had a tin whistle. I had a couple of changes of clothes. And one thing I couldn't bear to part with was my pith helmet, which had been given to me by a friend. And it proved incredibly useful. And it was useful for all sorts of reasons, some very practical reasons. If you're sailing, this little rowboat, I should explain, also had a sail. A mirror dinghy is a sailing dinghy. And when the boom was swinging over in a gale, very, very good head protection there, collected blackberries in it. At one stage in the North Sea, when I was way out in the middle of the channel and I got shipwrecked on a mud bank 2 miles out to sea in a gale, and I'd lost my bailer overboard, and I thought, what can I use? I thought, the pith helmet. And so I was bailing water with that. Very useful. But the most useful thing was that when you wear it, you immediately come across as somebody probably in need of help. And that was a really, really useful thing. And it's best demonstrated by one of my favourite stories. One night, I'd, after a few weeks, I'd actually rigged my dinghy up for sleeping on. It was just sort of putting some planks across it and unrolling a little mattress on it and putting an awning over it. And one very frosty October night, I was just setting my dinghy up for sleeping on, just outside Oxford, when I heard a voice, a stentorian voice, sort of bellowing from further up the towpath. And this sort of voice called out, "You! You there! What on earth are you doing?" And I looked up and I saw the archetypal English countrywoman. You know, the padded leather jacket, not padded leather jacket, the padded green country jacket, the Wellington boots, the couple of Labradors panting by her side, and she was swinging some dog leashes, sort of like a mace. And again, she sort of called out, "You, you, I'm talking to you, what are you doing?" And I thought, good God, it's my mother. I recognised the type immediately. Well, I apologised. I said, "Oh, look, I thought, no, it's private property. Sorry," I called out. Is this private property?" "I've absolutely no idea," she said. "No idea. Good Lord, is that a mirror dinghy?" she said. I said, "Yes. Yes, it is, actually." She said, "Good Lord. Now, you're not going to sleep on it tonight, are you?" And I explained that, yes, I am. I usually do. She took about 1 second, one deep breath, and said, "Absolute nonsense. You're coming back with me. I've got half a chicken needs eating up. Now come on, chop chop. Get your clogs on. Dogs are getting cold. Hurry up." And strode off. Well, I thought, okay, fate is calling me. So I gathered up a few odds and ends, and I shoved my pith helmet on my head, and I sort of trotted to heel along the towpath beside her or behind her. And she turned to me and fixed me with a sort of gimlety eye, and said, "Now, I'm a widow, mind you, and on my own, so I don't want any nonsense." Well, I can assure you, I was not intending to give her any nonsense. And there I was, standing with my pith helmet on, and she said, mind you, she said, "I don't think you're a madman." And she turned back and looked at me, standing there like that, and she said, "Well, actually, I do think you're mad, but I don't think you're dangerous. Now, come on. And she was wonderful. She was marvellous. And I will come back to her before I finish. But it was a wonderful example of hospitality and warmth and also the power of the pith helmet to look mad, but not dangerous. The journey carried on, and it was full of all sorts of things. It was full of, at times, extreme hardship. And from day one, I was wondering, what on earth am I doing here? There were times when, I remember on, this is a story I don't usually tell, so I don't know how it'll go, but I've been thinking about it. On the very, very first day, or I slept the first night after my farewell party, the very next day, breezily rowing along the canals, having got the hang of it by that stage, came to my first canal lock. I thought, oh, that's all right, I've been through these in narrow boats. And there was the lock keeper sitting there, a red-haired chap, sitting smoking a pipe. And I said, oh, hello, I can go through the lock. He shucked his pipe and said, nope. And I went, oh, right, okay, well, I'll wait for a narrow boat to come along. And he went, nope, no unpowered boats in the canal, I'm afraid. And not quite sure why I'm doing a West Country accent up in Shropshire, but never mind. I said, oh, right, surely, but can't I, perhaps I can be towed through? Nope, no towing in the locks. And I thought, crikey, this is going to be, well, as it turned out, this was the first of 484 locks that I went through, and it wasn't going well. So I finally went, oh, right, well, can I perhaps drag the boat up out of the water, and then, you know, we can lift it sort of down and put it in the canal on the other side? All right, he said. All right. He couldn't find a good reason not to. And so I emptied the boat out. I hauled it up, onto the bank, nearly breaking my back. Called him and said, thank you, I'm ready now. Ready for what? I said, well, I just wonder, could you help me sort of just lift it? No, can't get involved, I'm afraid. And I went, right. So I dragged the boat sort of all the way down the towpath, dumped it back in. Meanwhile, two workmen had come along and started helping me, and he immediately called them and told them to get back to work and not to help me. So his policy of non-involvement clearly didn't involve not getting involved enough to tell other people not to get involved, but a semantic point I wished to go through with him while shoving his pipe down his mouth, but I didn't. And anyway, I thought, oh, crikey, if this is going to be the policy, the British Waterways policy all the way for the next, I didn't know how far I was going to go, but I knew that there were another three locks just a couple of miles ahead. I thought, this is going to be very difficult. Well, I got to the next locks, as I say, a couple of miles ahead, and there was a man waiting there, a Welshman. And I rather belligerently went up to him and said, right, locks, this dinghy, is there a problem with me going through? Being a bit belligerent. He said, oh, no. No, boy, oh, not a problem at all, he said. And that's beginning to be a little bit Irish, isn't it? But I can't do it, a glass of wine. And he said, oh, not a problem there, boy, oh, no, a lovely little dinghy like that, I can go through the boat. And I went, through the lock. And I said, well, I don't have a motor or anything, it's not powered. He said, oh, no, you've got a couple of oars there. Hey, that's powered in my book. And I went, right, so I could take this dinghy through these locks. He said, oh, yes, not a problem. I said, well, it's just the lock keeper back at Frankston Locks said, it said there was a real problem. And he said, and I apologise for the slight the nature of this comment, but he did actually say it. He said, oh, you don't want to mind Colin back there. What he wants is a big black mama to spank some joy into him, he said. So, And I still couldn't quite believe it, so I said, so sorry, I'm getting this right, I can take this lock, this little dinghy is allowed through these locks, unpowered though it is. He said, absolutely. Come next April, when they're open, you can go through as many times as you like. I said, what? Oh, next April, they're not open now. They're all derelict. Next April, they'll be like new pins. You can go through them and back and through them as much as you like. But, dearie me. So, anyway, I actually found that the canal had run out at this stage. My map reading had not been good. So, this is a little illustration of that I set off with enormous confidence, but not a lot of preparation on the way. So, there were all sorts of obstacles and problems on the way. The obstacles I do enjoy talking about, and I get asked about a lot, is crossing the English Channel. Now, as I'd been coming down through the rivers of England and across the Kennet and Avon Canal and then onto the Thames, and I'd turned and went all the way up the Thames to the source, and it was wonderful. It was a lovely sort of adventure, because I had all this leisure time, and we so rarely have it, don't we? But I was like one of those enviable adventurers from children's books, you know, Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn or whatever, or just who I came to the River Thames. I thought I could go downstream to London, I could go upstream to the source. Let's go upstream. I've got all the time. It was that sort of lovely adventure. So I went all the way up and then all the way back down, and as I got closer and closer to London, my confidence increased. I'd got the hang of the boat, and I thought, this is a jolly good little boat. I could possibly sail this across the channel. You know, Dunkirk and all that sort of thing. Without the shells and the stupors and the snow geese flapping around. And people sort of up in the Midlands, up sort of Oxford way, had gone, Sandy, no. You could not. Going across the English Channel would be like crossing the M24 on your hands and knees if you were a hamster. You know, it would be ridiculous in rush hour. It's incredibly busy. You must not even contemplate it. And I thought, they might have something there. But as I got further and further down, and when I got to Calais, and I thought, I feel that I could do it, but I better ask for some advice. I better look around for people to put me off. So, you know, I went to the harbour master and spoke to him. And he went, oh, crossing the English Channel, the Mirradingi. Yes. My daughter went across on a windsurfer the other day. Yeah. Well, you know what 8-year-olds are like. She's got a pen friend over there or something. And people were incredibly blasé about it. They were just absolutely relaxed about it. And I thought, oh, okay. And I finally thought, well, I'll ring the Coast Guard. And they'll know. You know, they're the people who are paid to know how dangerous these things are and to give advice. And I was really relieved that once I rang the Coast Guard, I heard this stern note of warning coming into the voice on the other end of the phone. Crossing the English Channel in an 11-foot Mirradingi. Well, let me give you some advice, son, he said. And I went, yes. He said, right, okay, now have you got a pen? I want you to write this down. Yep. So, you know, phone cooked under here, pen here. And he said, now, as you'll be heading on a bearing of blah, 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 blah. Oh, can't remember what it was. When you're approaching Calais, you'll see large green buoys. Now, this is the bit I want you to notice. Large green buoys, you will keep them to the starboard. I'm not writing green buoys. Starboard, good. And when you're approaching Calais, there is a very large jetty or pier that sticks out from the harbour. That's the entrance to the harbour. Pier, entrance to the harbour. And on it, there is a very, very clear landmark. You can't miss it. Large white building right on the end. Large white building. He said, now, whatever you do, that's a seafood restaurant. Don't go there and have dinner, because I went there last August and was sick as a dog. But apart from that, good luck. Bye. And that was it. That was the sole nautical advice I got from the Coast Guard about sailing an 11-foot Mirradingi across the English Channel. So there you go. Don't eat the moule marinière in that particular restaurant. So it was rather extraordinary. Now, when I got to France, and I'm leaving out a lot, as you can tell, but when I got to France, I found that things changed a little. In England, of course, I spoke English beautifully. because of my old teacher. I could even speak Old English, Anglo-Saxon, Middle English, dialects, all those sorts of things. I just get Welsh and West Country muddled up sometimes. But French, I thought I spoke French until I arrived in France. I was taught French here in Adelaide at Pulteney Grammar by a very, very dear old man, a very well-loved teacher, Mr. Robson, who taught me French and spoke French with an absolutely perfect English accent. So almost nothing that I heard when I got to France resembled in the slightest Mr. Robson's vocabulary. Anyway, this caused one or two little problems. I remember one evening I was tying up beside a canal in a beautiful little woodland glade by a village, a little village in the middle of a glade. And to be honest, France was stunningly beautiful. I was going right through there in the months of May. I'll talk about that later. But anyway, a Frenchman came down from a little house by the riverside, and he came up and made all those extraordinary noises that French people make, which was sort of a bit incomprehensible, but it was full of ouf, non, bon courage, je le donne, c'est dans mon petit hon, je le tue, etc. Which I hope I haven't said anything rude then. But he gradually it came clear that he was saying, but no, ce n'est pas possible, you sleep here, no, it's not possible. And I was explaining to him and saying, tried to explain to him that, I'm actually very comfortable because I've got this little mattress that I unroll. And so I said to him, in my best schoolboy French, very proud of myself, I said, non, non, monsieur. That's no, no, sir, just in case you didn't know. Non, non, monsieur. À nuit, at night, je suis très confortable. I am very comfortable. Because j'ai une petite maîtresse. And of course, since you're laughing, you will know, and if you're only pretending to laugh, I'll tell you, because what I'd actually said, of course, was, non, non, monsieur, at night, I am very comfortable, because I have a little mistress. Which the French understood completely. Very understanding of them. And so on. And look, it didn't get any better. This man very kindly did explain. He said, oh, monsieur, non, non, it's not the right word. What you are talking about is the word for a mattress is matelas. And I went, okay, must remember that. Well, unfortunately, 2 weeks later, I came across an exactly similar situation. A man came down and went, oh, je le sens pas bon. Pourquoi? And I thought, oh, I'm getting better at this. I will say, non, non, monsieur, à nuit, je suis très confortable. I'm very comfortable. Parce que, must get the word right, it's not a maîtresse. Parce que j'ai un petit matelot. In which, of course, I had now admitted to being made very comfortable at night by my little sailor boy. So, and again, the French were very understanding. So, very liberal people. So, life went on. When I got to Germany, I was never taught German at all, though Anglo-Saxon came into use very occasionally if I wanted to, attack the fortress with 1,000 spears. I knew exactly how to do it. And order a skull full of mead. That was precisely, that was fine. But are there any, are the Germans, interesting people, are there any Germans here? No? Oh, good. Oh, there's one over there. Right, well, block your ears for this one, No, the Germans turned out to be absolutely wonderful, but there's one little story that slightly, when I first sailed into Germany, slightly put me off. I was, I made my way busking, playing a little tin whistle. It's something I do occasionally. I play my little tin whistle out in the street and people throw money at me to make me stop. I had my hat out and I was playing in this beautiful little fairy tale town called Cochem on the Moselle, a very gorgeous little place. It could have been the setting for the Pied Piper of Hamelin, except it wasn't, because it was Hamlin that was the Piper of Hamlin, but Cochem. And I was playing away a merry little tune in the market square. And up came this German tour guide, and she had a whole train of American and Canadian tourists. And she actually came and stood, this square was large and spacious, but she came and stood right up against me, pressing me up against the fountain so that I could barely move, and was saying, gas around, please, ladies and gentlemen, gas around. Right, now here we are in the beautiful marketplace or rat house, and here you'll see, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she started explaining the features of the square. And because I was sort of jammed up here, I couldn't go on playing my tin whistle, so I just politely stopped, otherwise I would have actually been playing it in her ear. So I sort of politely stopped and just waited, and she went on and gave the whole little tour and said, yeah, you will notice the fountain over there. The fountain is of a goat being trampled by a monk. There's a very interesting story about that, which I will tell you now, and so on and so on. And after about 6-7 minutes of this, she said, good, now we go up to the Schloss. If you'd meet me over there by the steps, then we will go up. Raus, come on, raus, go, we in hurry, yeah, good. And started moving off. Well, to make up for a little bit of lost time, just as they were all moving away, I started up my tin whistle again. I thought, oh, I'll try and wring a little bit of money out of the tourists. So I started playing Yankee Doodle Dandy and a few American tunes. And this tour guide came back to me and said something like, yadi, 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 Deutschmark. And I didn't understand, but I assumed she was saying something like, ah, yeah, how beautiful your playing is, how you enhance our lovely town, where can I throw some Deutschmark? So I sort of indicated to my hat, and I said, where she could throw some money. Well, she strode up to it, she rummaged around, she took out 5 Deutschmark, came back to me, held them up in my nose, and said, that is for listening to my tour. And off she went. So it's the only time I've ever lost money busking. But because we have our friend over here who's looking really distressed and upset, and I'm so sorry to take the mickey out of your...
I can't sound surprised.
Oh, really? But the next little story I will tell, I hope, it certainly made up for it in my mind. Am I going on too much? I mean, I'm happy to sort of... No, no, okay, right, good. Again, a little further down or up the river in Germany, I was anchored one night in a little marina, and it was about 3 miles to the nearest town. And I needed, for some reason, to make an important phone call. So I started walking into town to find a phone. But to my delight, I found a pub, or what looked like a pub, sort of glass windows, a sign outside with a winged figure on it. I thought, oh, it's the equivalent of the Fox and Hounds. It's the two-headed eagle or something like that. And sure enough, peered in the windows and there were people sitting around having a pint and enjoying themselves. And I thought, oh, there might be a phone there. So I wandered in and asked, and sure enough, made my phone call quickly and thought, well, while I'm here, I'll sit and enjoy a pint of good German beer. So I wandered up to the bar and they appeared to, it must have been a quiz night or something, because there were people sitting around, you know, with pen and paper and so on, but a convivial atmosphere. And I went up to the barman and said, in my fairly non-existent German, eine Bier, bitte. And the barman looked at me a little askance, and I thought, oh, my German must be worse than I thought. But anyway, he poured me a lovely pint of beer, handed it over, and when I went to pay, the peculiar thing was the man didn't take the money, but he took a large plastic pigeon and waved it at me. And I thought, oh, interesting. And he waved it at me, and I finally realised when he stopped waving it that there was a slit in the head of the pigeon. It was like a piggy bank or a pidgey bank, really. Ha ha. And I thought, oh, okay. Put the money in there. Interesting German till arrangements. But anyway, I went and grabbed my pint, and a very nice gentleman down here sitting at a table said, oh, yeah, come, sit. And they were lovely. They asked about where I was from, what I was doing. They were fascinated with the whole dinghy thing. They asked me a few stories. I told them a few anecdotes, etc., etc. We had a lovely sort of long chat, and after about half an hour, I thought, oh, well, have another pint. So I went up and asked, ein Bier bitte, you know, and again, a little bit of an odd look, but the pigeon came out and I put my money in the pigeon. And I went and sat down, and I could sort of feel the atmosphere just cooling a little. So I had a bit of time, rather than chatting, I had a little time to sit around, to look around whilst sipping my pint, and I noticed a trophy sort of cabinet-y thing over there with lots of little trophies with winged helmet figures in them, and over there some banners on the wall that all seem to have little winged things on them, and then just here, right here, I should have perhaps seen it before, a poster, Racing Pigeons of the World. I thought, well, there's a very pigeony theme to this pub. And finally, it had all fallen very quiet by then. And I turned to the man who'd been chatting and been my very kind host and said, sorry, this is a pub, isn't it? And he suddenly looked a little bit embarrassed and went, well, actually, now that you ask, nein, this is the Kelheim Racing Pigeon Club, and this is our annual general meeting. I went, oh, right. Sorry. He said, no, nein. It has been very interesting to talk to you, but perhaps we get on now, yeah? So, yes, blundering my way across Europe, I'm afraid. The diplomatic corps has their gain, really, me being a teacher. I will perhaps share one more story, and then perhaps we can have some questions, and that might prompt something, and so on. People often ask me about the whether I encountered any trouble with visas and all those sorts of things, which are such an important part of travel. And I must say that yes, I did, but I managed them, and they don't make a large part of my book, because I like to think that my journey was like something that might have happened in the 18th century. I like to picture myself as a sort of a Dr. Dolittle figure, sort of just slipping down the river to the sea. I think I start the book, some of you may remember, that I start with a reference to Dr. Dolittle, and that lovely line in it about Dr. Dolittle jumped on his ship with his pig and his duck and his parrot and his dog and sailed away and bumped into Africa. And I loved that. I loved that idea of going off without, you know, timetables and visas and passports and airports and so on. So the whole journey did have this lovely picaresque. Is that the word? Picaresque? Have I got the right word? Good. Such a good English education I had. made up feel. But sometimes I did bump into the cold hand of bureaucracy, and my favourite story about that is this. I finally made my way down the Danube and into used to be called the Eastern Bloc countries, and they are very, very different from Western Europe. You know, there's a really quite different air, and I felt at times that I had come to real Wilderland and was approaching the borders of Mordor and so on. And at one stage, I was coming down the river. The Danube is very wide at this stage, and as it goes from country to country, from Yugoslavia to Bulgaria to Romania, there are border crossings, of course, and these rivers, because they have a large amount of traffic on them, they have harbours and harbour masters and border patrol people. And I pulled in at one in Bulgaria and went through the usual process, showed my visa to the large, fat harbour master or border control person sitting up in his little office smoking a small cigarette behind his desk, and showed the various things I had to, and went to go, and he said, wait, where are, I have not seen your ship's papers. And I went, what? Ship's papers? And I went, yes, I must see your ship's papers. And I said, no, look, it's a tiny little dinghy. I don't know why I did a Cockney accent there. It's a little dinghy. It doesn't have ship's papers. Well, no, you must show me ship's papers. I cannot let you go until I've seen ship's papers. And I said, no, please, come and have a look. And he came out of the chair, sort of waddled to the edge of the pier, looked down 40 feet to where my little dinghy was down there, and went, his ship needs ship's papers. And in vain, I argued with him. But he was adamant. He went back to his desk. He would not give me back my passport. He would not give me my papers until he had seen ship's papers. And so finally I thought, right, okay, right. So I went down to my dinghy. I got my bag out. I took out my art pad that I had with me. I took out my nice calligraphy pen. I ripped out a nice bit of paper. And I wrote at the top of the paper, ship's papers. And then I started writing, name of vessel, Jack De Crow, master of vessel, A.J. McKinnon, registration number, 123456, oddly, coincidentally, or whatever. And I had great fun with it, cargo, and I wrote gossamer, rainbows, daydreams, magic tricks, watercolours, things like that, and so on, and I was getting a little carried away, and I thought, well, to make this official, I'll draw a crest at the top. So I drew a sort of a crow and an anchor with sort of windy rope around it to make it official. Now, by this stage, the harbour master had got out of his desk, had wandered across, and was standing over me as I sat on the steps in the sun, watching me like this. And then he went, yes, you need a little mermaid here, I think. No, it must have a curly tail. Yeah. Yes, good. I like you need another one here. With boobies. Yeah, good. And after I'd finished, I blew the whole thing dry. He'd gone back to his desk. I blew the thing dry. I folded it up. And I went back to him and went, oh, ship's papers. Oh. And he took it from me without any sense of surprise. He said, yes, I knew you would have ship's papers somewhere. Now, tung, 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 go, go, I'm a very busy man. So, So, bureaucracy. It gets everywhere, not just university management committees. I wonder whether perhaps this might be a good point to let you rest from my voice alone. I wonder whether perhaps there are any questions. I don't know how we're going for time. So
if we're going well, you want to conduct them?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. Yes, yes. Are there any questions at all about either Jack De Crow or anything else at all? Yes.
Mine is not really a question, but I have the pleasure of following your journey in a much larger craft after I had read your book. Oh. And every time we came into a lock and looked at the narrow area and the ladder going down, and I thought, how on earth do that? Tie up your tiny little dinghy and with the differentiation of water levels. So all through this trip I kept thinking.
Right, right. Well, one of the locks differed. An interesting part of the journey was actually just seeing how all the locks differed from country to country, and they differ substantially. And some of them are ingenious, and some of them are impossible, and so on. Talking of tying up, in Bath has the deepest lock in Britain. And I had not been terribly used to it. And I very, very nearly died because I wasn't thinking. I came into the bottom of the lock. You come into the bottom, you close the gates, and then you fill the whole thing up with water. That takes your boat all the way to the top, and then you can sail out at the top. Well, what I'd done in this occasion, that was usually fine. I'd sort of sail in. I had a long rope or painter, which I could tie to the very top, and then by the time it came up, that was fine. I found in this lock it was so deep that the rope only reached halfway up the lock. And I thought, oh, well, that's no problem. I'll just tie it to the ladder, halfway up the ladder. So I sort of came up the ladder, tied it on, went to operate the lock. And as the water was filling, when it was about here, I thought, oh, when it's completely full, my boat is going to be tethered to a ladder some 20 feet underwater. Now, stupidly, I did not sort of go, all right, quick, stop the filling mechanism before I do anything. I thought, oh, better get it untied. I shinnied down the ladder, halfway down and was hanging onto it with one hand while trying to undo the knot with my other hand, which was almost impossible. And the water was rising and rising and rising and rising, and I felt like one of those heroines in a flooded cellar as the hero or the villain is playing the William Tell overture overhead, you know, and to drown out the cries. And the water was up to here before I finally managed to get the rope untied, and I just managed to avoid taking a large mouthful of rotten badger, because these locks have all sorts of dead creatures in them. They're just sort of hedgehog and rabbit soup, really, some of them. And that was silly of me. And yes, locks were a considerable hazard. So, other questions? Yes, at the back there.
I have practicality-wise, what do you do for showers and toilets?
Yeah, no, good question. In terms of washing, I got into the habit of bathing every day, sometimes twice a day, morning and evening, in the rivers, and that was actually and canals, and that was really, really, really lovely. Oddly enough, it's amazing how human beings get used to things. I remember for about a week and a half, I was going through Germany, and I was bathing in rivers each morning and emptying a bailer full of water all over me, cool river water, and just drying off and being out in the sunlight and shaving with a little mirror while just sitting on the side of the canal. And yet all this time, I was thinking, oh, I can't wait to get to a town and perhaps where I can afford to go and have a night in a hotel. And I finally did. I came to the town of somewhere, Wurzheim, I think, and thought, I'll treat myself to a hotel. And I went to a really nice hotel. And it was a perfectly good hotel, luxurious. I had a hot shower, which you would have thought was lovely. It was so claustrophobic. It was so steamy. I felt so unclean afterwards because I felt sticky. It compared to having mud squishing between my toes and the reeds rustling and swans and ducks and the bright fresh air. Sleeping in the proper bed that night, I almost suffocated. It was somehow awful. There was no fresh breeze on my face, and it was astonishing that I missed the outdoor life so much. I was very fortunate with the weather. It was the hottest summer on record, I think, as I went right across Germany. So I was sleeping out many nights. I didn't bother setting up my dinghy to sleep on. I didn't sleep under an awning. I just put my tarpaulin on the grass and slept out under the stars. And it was, well, to steal a title from another author, Patrick Leigh Fermor, it was a time of gifts. And it really was. I mean, I understood that title of his book, his travel book, when I had slept out under stars. There were nightingales in the trees, and it was astonishing. You know, to me, nightingales are almost mythical birds, magical birds. I know they're real, but they're not common. And as I was reading, I had one book of Keats. That was the only English book I had, apart from The Tempest. And I got so bored, I learnt all the Keats poetry off by heart as I went, and then most of The Tempest. And it was astonishing. Tom, you would have loved this. Anybody who loves poetry would have loved this. As I went, all the poems that I read of Keats, slowly through the whole journey, one by one came true as I went. So the very first time I learnt the whole of the Ode to a Nightingale off by heart, I had just got it off Pat. That night I went to sleep under a walnut tree in France, and a nightingale was singing above me in the tree. Later I learnt Ode to a Grecian Urn, and there's all that bit about the little Greek city that stands empty, emptied of its people this happy morn. And I came round a corner of the Danube, and there was, it's called Valhalla, but it's actually a replica of the Parthenon, sitting on a great, beautiful hill above the river, built by one of the mad Ludwigs. And it was the Keats poem embodied there. Later, last one, I'll promise you, Ode to Autumn, I was reading that, and I came down through Serbia, Yugoslavia, and it was autumn. And not only were the leaves falling and we had that season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, but the practices they're still using in those Eastern Bloc countries are the scythes and the cider presses and the oil presses and so on. This wonderful rural thing. And I was astonished. That doesn't answer anything about toilets. I'm sorry. And amazing. I can't remember how I went to the toilet. It's one of those things that blots out, which is good, I reckon. Another question. Yes?
I just wonder if you've got any comment on how you wrote the book. You've obviously got a phenomenal memory, but did you sort of keep notes or a journal or have photographs? Or how did you go about...
Yes, no, look, a good question. It's actually very easy. I've never kept a journal, but whenever I've travelled, I've always written very long, very extensive, tediously detailed letters to my family and friends back home. And I suppose that's always actually been a good discipline. It covers two bases. It keeps a record of your trip. It also keeps people informed, loved ones back home informed. But the third thing it does is, of course, it's better than a journal because you're forced to turn every little episode into a bit of a story. You've got an audience that you need to entertain. You want them to see the colours you're seeing, to experience the tension that you're experiencing and then the release. So really, by the time I had finished both journeys, I went to my friends and bought my letters back from them used them largely. But I never took photographs. I, in one part of my Jack DeCrow book, I think I tell my readers what I think of photographs. Only because I'm not a good photographer. So that photographs can't pick up the nightingale song and can't pick up the smell of beech woods in autumn and so on. So to me, they're flat and very one-dimensional. There was a question here, yes.
When did you replace your
pet helmet? Oh, well, it got stolen by a German. possibly. It may have been somebody, an English person, living in Germany at the time. And so I never replaced it, but I've done a number of these talks now, and I've had now... We count five occasions when people have later sent me a pith helmet to replace one. Sorry?
I nearly wore mine.
Oh, right. Well, there you go. No, it's been rather touching up in the Monero, where I've done a few of these talks, and there's usually some old timer in the audience who says, "Oh, I've got a pith helmet at home in the shed. I'll send it to you." So the pith helmet is sometimes not popular. I sometimes do a talk and, as I say, demonstrated this. And one man came up to me after one talk and said, "Yeah, enjoyed the talk. Lose the pith helmet." Doesn't really matter. So, everyone's a critic. But, yes.
I just wondered if you could say a few words about your second book.
Yes.
Which I haven't had the pleasure of reading yet. But I gather a lot of it was through Asia.
Yes.
Where bureaucracy must have been rather difficult to cope with.
Yes, it was. It was indeed. Look, quickly about my second book. How are we going for time? Is it
4.5 minutes?
4.5 minutes. Very, very quickly about my second book. It's called The Well at the World's End, and the reason it's called that is I'll tell it very, very simply. Many, many, many years ago, long before the trip actually happened, when I was 19, and I went to visit the island of Iona, in Scotland, a very, very beautiful, holy place and remote. And there on the ferry, midwinter, the only other person on the ferry was this very, very beautiful girl, dewy eyes, long brown hair. And I sort of sidled up to her by the ferry railing and said, "It's very beautiful here, isn't it?" And she turned to me and looked at me and said, "Oh my God, the vibes here are so harmonious." And before I could tiptoe away and say, "I'm just going over here," she said, "Hello, my name. What's your name? What's your name?" And I said, "Sandy." She said, "Oh, no, you're kidding. No, tell me, really, what's your name?" And I said, "It's Sandy." "Oh, you kidder, you mystery man. Hi, my name's Pixie Peterson." Now, actually, that wasn't her real name. I actually had to make a name up. Her real name is Better, and I couldn't use it, but I couldn't better it. Her real name, and I apologise if she's a friend of yours or is here in the audience, her real name was Chucky Walter. And she found my name funny, so... And to cut a long story short, she slightly pursued me. I later found out that she was only pursuing me because she wanted me to pay the hotel bill for no other reason. But I felt very pursued at the time, and I was a very shy young 19-year-old who was not used to being pursued at all. And but to cut a long story short, I found my way to a certain little spring on Iona, which is known as the Well of Eternal Youth. And I'd found this old guidebook in one of the hotels there. And it actually said, pilgrims must come by land and by sea to visit the Well of Eternal Youth, which can endow eternal youth upon it. And I thought, wonderful, this is fantastic. It's not every day you find something as enchanted and magical as that. And because this young Californian lady was sort of slightly pursuing me, I sort of closed the book and dashed off, and later found my way to the Well of Eternal Youth. And there, in midwinter, freezing, I thought, well, you don't find a well every day. I'm going to make the most of it. I was thinking of Achilles dipped into the water, and I stripped off, and I bathed in the Well of Eternal Youth, and I made sure that every little bit of me was immersed, because I didn't want any bits of me growing old, that, you know. And I got right in. I came out glowing with the feeling, it's working, something to do with the hypothermia setting in. And it was only later when I was leaving the island, and I'd actually been given this little guidebook, and I thought, yes, and I stepped onto the mainland and was reading, pilgrims must come by land and by sea and go to the Well of Eternal Youth at the first rays of the sun to drink from the Well of Eternal Youth. I thought, bugger. So, years later, 8 or 9 years later, when I'd been teaching for 4 or 5 years and I was beginning to feel jaded, I looked in the mirror, I looked much older than I felt, and I needed a break. And I thought, I'm going to go back to the Well of Eternal Youth. And I checked in this book again, by land and by sea. I thought, I mucked it up first time, I'm going to follow it to the letter this time. I'm not going to fly any of the way. And I went, to be honest, I'd already had a holiday organised in New Zealand, so I started at the very southern tip of New Zealand and absolutely made myself, difficult though it was, to get all the way to the Well of Eternal Youth on Iona without flying any of the way. So that's what the second book is about. I'm sorry, we've probably run out of time to be able to talk more about it. I'll just finish off. I'll round up just by saying I'll go back to that lady who with the Labradors. I like to say this. I often am slightly surprised that I'm asked to speak. I enjoy speaking, but I don't feel I have anything very profound to say. It's just showing off, really, and it's just sort of telling traveller's tales, and we all have traveller's tales. But if I have to say something profound, it's not even profound, but I think it's true, which is even better. It's this. I didn't set off on either of the journeys. I didn't set off to find a Northwest Passage or to find hidden treasure or a lost kingdom or anything like that. So I had no aim in either of the journeys. But what I did discover is this. The media, if you rely on the media to make judgments about the world, you would be convinced that the world is a dark and dangerous and hostile place, that it's a place where the stranger cannot be trusted, where you take somebody into your own home at your own peril. And I know bad things happen, and I sometimes hesitate to say this because there could be somebody sitting here in the audience to whom awful things have happened, a mugging, a robbing, a bashing, a death, or whatever, and I know those things happen. But I think if you rely on the media, you get a very distorted view of the world. And as I say, I didn't set off to discover anything, but I did discover a place in which people are heroically trusting, heroically generous and courageous and warm and wonderful and dotty, and they, you know, it's a good place to have discovered. And you get there. The best way of getting there is by Mirradingi, wearing a pith helmet, and I wish you luck on the same adventure. Thank you very much.